Welcome to, or welcome back to, the Lifetime Athlete Podcast. This is the show where our mission is to bring science and common sense together and help everyone to achieve peak performance, peak athletic performance at any age, and also to really rock it and crush it in relationships and business and finance and life. So thanks for being with me today. And thanks to the giggling guy who is like me, like a schoolboy. PK, good morning.
Good morning, Jay-Z. I love how you dropped. We're here to help you crush relationships. And we're going to talk about squatting. That's just a beautiful juxtaposition. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So if we were doing seasons, we really haven't done seasons on this show yet or for any reason. It's just kind of a straight run. But this is episode number 149. So technically, this would be our ninth season if we were getting into that. Isn't that awesome that we've been spending time together as bros, coaches, bro coaches, broaches?
Absolutely. 149. Wow. Now, you have to give yourself some credit. You've had some solo missions in there. But yeah, it's a pleasure to, you know, get up into that 150. That's, you know, we think, oh, we hit 50, we hit, you know, whatever, 149. Wow.
Yes. And you already mentioned that today's topic is all about squatting. And the title is You Do Know Squat. sometimes my jokes make me just wonder, why do I come up with these things? But nonetheless, it's a commonly occurring topic or frequently asked question, you know, all about squatting. You know, how can I squat? Should I squat? How do I squat? Is squatting good for me? Is it bad? So forth, so on. And most recently, the Training Tribe, you know, which is our online coaching and group training platform, was doing a masterclass, which was very well received about this topic of squatting and kind of bringing it into our language and our repertoire. So I wanted to share that with the audience here of the podcast, and that's kind of why we're here doing what we're doing today.
Absolutely. So I'm excited to get into the squat stuff, but what's the tribe been up to lately before we dive into the specifics?
Oh man, that's been so exciting. Thanks for asking.
You got it.
We were working on this block periodization model where we've got the training year divided up into five different blocks. And those blocks sort of oscillate in terms of how much is emphasized within the five major capacities of human performance. And so those things are strength, speed, power, endurance, and agility. And we always, you know, touch on all five items, but in this fall block, we're working on trying to bring up our endurance a bit. And so endurance having, you know, kind of a split personality where there's muscular endurance or fatigue resistance in terms of reps. And then there's also this cardiorespiratory oxygen utilization endurance fitness. And so we just came off of our monthly, last week we did KPI tests. KPIs are key performance indicators. And now we're going into a deload week, which I must say for myself is welcomed, because those tests were fun, but they were tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're only looking at a couple of different things. You know, we're looking at the 5K run, mm-hmm. max push-ups in 1 minute, maximum time that you can hold the lunge position left and right, and then also max time hanging from a bar, otherwise known as the dead hang. And, you know, in order to make things fun and exciting, how we did it was like, okay, first of all, let's look at this 5K and say, you know, the basic entry-level athleticism per the Lifetime Athlete standards is just simply to be able to do this. Sprint a 40 without blowing up, run a mile without stopping, walk 5 without becoming exhausted. Those are good entry-level parameters. But for this group, you know, they're, okay, let's work on endurance a little bit, and let's use running 3.1 miles, which is 5 kilometers, as our measure. And so it is not a sprint. Many people think it is. It's actually an endurance event, the 5K. So mm-hmm. we ran that 5K, and I had one of those days where I felt pretty good, and I managed to pour the pitcher as far as energy out pretty evenly. I was like, okay, I ran pretty well, and I did those tests, but I was tired, and there was some soreness from giving that kind of effort for a couple days, and so now I'm appreciating the deload. But what inspired me the most was a comment that one of our tribe members posted on the T2 forum. And actually, I don't have that up, but I'm going to grab it real quick so I can at least read part of it for you to share.
Sure.
And thank you for allowing me to be modestly prepared, as is often the case. And thanks, audience. You're awesome. Okay, so here we go. I don't think I'll even use a name, but this tribe member had this to say. What I love about this group is the variety of people and goals, the self-pacing, and allowing for a competitive athletic feel. Yet knowing the ultimate goal is individual fitness or whatever activity we want to do in life. Pride compels me to preface my report with the fact that I am status 10.5 months post C5, C6 disc posterior and right-sided protrusion. So there's some medical history there, and we made sure that this individual was cleared before participating in the tribe. But back to her comments, gratitude brings me to write, without the help of this group, I doubt I'd be able to complete any of these tasks now. And then she went on and explained her results and what the final score was, and then said, I'm thrilled.
Fantastic. I mean, that's a really, I guess, personal but holistic view. And someone only writes something like that when they're really getting a lot out of it.
Yeah, which exactly gives me that feeling that I'm looking for. It's like helping folks to, you know, get things out of it. In fact, I never told what I meant to tell when I was talking about the KPI test. We turned those into like a little fun competition, both amongst others and within ourselves. And then how you do it is you take your 5K time, and then you convert your number of push-up reps into seconds, subtract that from the 5K time, then subtract the times that you hold for those isometric positions to come up with a final number. And that's really the target that we're all going to be shooting for lowering next month.
Absolutely. That's great.
The game.
It seems simple too, though. I just jotted it down and seems straightforward.
Yeah, the gamification of fitness. I think that's, you know, you want to test, you want to compete sometimes, but never, ever should we lose the element of play, because that's where the joy is.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic.
So thank you for letting me share that. And then this back to this, you do know squat. So, you know, after this talk, nobody's ever going to say to you, you don't know squat.
Fair enough. So I'm assuming like we should just start high level. Like, let's talk about the squat.
Yes. The squat is one of seven basic movement patterns. And so everyone will recognize that, you know, in human function and movement and training, we have these basic patterns, or sometimes called big patterns, like Dr. Pat Davidson likes to say. But you've got the squat, the hinge, push, pull, twist, lunge, and ambulate. And so those are the patterns. And, you know, breaking out, we're looking at the squat today. And it is really, even though the word functional sometimes takes a beating these days, it is a functional position. It's how we get up and down. And it's also a position that we can or should be able to use at the bottom, such as tending the campfire. Let's say if you want to go back and look at squatting ancestrally, or you could say, well, if you either A, can't get into a full squat, or when you're down there, it doesn't feel like a rest position, it feels like misery, that might be something we want to address. And squatting is different than the hinge, which is another one of the big patterns. And so the hinge, or, you know, when you're training, you're often thinking of the deadlift, that's more of a pull pattern, or at least you call that a pull. The squat is actually a vertical push.
Interesting. Could you explain that?
Yes. So I think I'll even save talking too much about hinging and deadlifting and pulling, you know, for another time. But basically, with the squat, it's the way that we work perpendicular to gravity. So we ascend and we descend. And, you know, obviously when we're descending, we are, you know, we're moving eccentrically and we're yielding. And we're almost, let's say, compressing a spring. And then, of course, when we're ascending, that's more concentric or overcoming in terms of terms that we like to use about contractions. But you know, that's really what a squat is. It's more, much more piston like when you break it down.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So from there, we might say, well, what are the mechanics of squatting, you know, the biomechanics, if you will, how do you break that down? And I've actually got a list prepared here of things that I can talk about, and it may not be every item that I would ever cover with a group or a client, but it's most of them. And I think that our challenge today, it's a good challenge, is basically through words and through your skillful, you know, prying and cueing of me, we'll be able to create a picture of all these things.
Well, let's do it. Where would we start?
I would start with what, you know, it's most commonly called the stack. And so that's a stacking or orientation of the rib cage over the pelvis. And, and so that's
that
been,
a little bit for me.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to give credit where it's due. You know, these are things that we've studied and talked about in, you know, the physical performance world for decades, but it's really been brought forward or developed a lot recently by Bill Hartman. Bill Hartman's a physical therapist in Indiana, and you know, he's really kind of done some groundbreaking work in helping everyone to understand, you know, how these relationships between the rib cage and pelvis work and how that's ideal for really managing our viscous innards or our visceral contents. And again, others have picked that up and pushed it along. So I want to say that, but really all that we're thinking about with a stack is orienting yourself, you know, back to gravity again, so that the rib cage is like a cylinder that is, you know, extending down. And then within that is the pelvis or pelvic floor, and everything is sort of, you know, lined up, and we're not looking at something that's bent or curved.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. That does make sense. So you're drawing a straight line between, because I was going to ask what would be happening if you weren't stacking properly, and that would be that curve or that bend. Okay. Got it.
Yes. And to maybe try to explain that better, when we have the stack, then we form the cylinder, which is then,
there we go,
best pressurized, because a cylinder is one of those strong structures to manage pressure, like a soda can you can think of. And so that's what we want. If we have something that looks like a banana, that's, you can squish a banana a lot easier than you can a Coke can. So that there's an idea for you there. We don't want squishing when we're about to go down.
No, especially if
we're under load when doing so. Okay, so that's the stack. And then the next thing I like to do is I say, hey, let's think about the spine or the spine and pelvis. And another term, you know, I mentioned functional, that's a term that takes a beating. Well, here's another one, neutral. You know, so people get all uptight, oh man, you know, neutral. Well, all I'm saying, and I think all most people are saying, is that our with respect to the position and tilting of our pelvis and then arching or rounding of our back, we're close to the middle. You know, we're somewhere in the mid range. And the reason for that is, again, that's going to be orienting towards that cylinder more, but also it gives us this magical thing called movement variability. So, you know, you do have the ability then to make adjustments a few degrees in any direction as indicated. Whereas if you lock it up, you know, you've kind of lost some motion, which might be useful in, you know, this mechanical lowering and raising of the beast.
Yes. Okay. Tracking.
Okay. So now we go to one of my favorite ones, and that's the hips and how it relates to the stance or the placement of our feet when we're squatting up and down. Okay. Keep going, John.
You're going to keep going.
Yeah, no worries. So for the most part, where you place your feet is going to be determined or even dictated by the hips that you were born with. And so what we know about hip formation, congenital, acquisition of hip shape in the human, is that not everybody's the same. Some people have, hips that are turned in a bit more. That's called antiversion. Some people's hips are turned out a little more. That's retroversion. The total amount of motion within joints due to bony constraints and also tissues will be different from person to person. And so what happens is we generally do best with the squat when we place our feet, obviously our legs relating to the hip, where we have that movement variability again. So where that hip is roughly in neutral or mid-range. And so for a person who, let's say, does very well with a narrow stance and feet straight ahead, that's probably because their hips have that movement available. And then a person who goes a little wider and has a little more toe out, even as far as what's called a sumo stance, which you can picture, a lot of that has to do with, again, how you're put together. And so how I help people to find this is very basic. This is how I was taught. You simply close your eyes, stand in a safe place, and march in place a couple times, and then stop. Open your eyes, look down, and see where you've placed your feet. And oftentimes, it's going to line up or be, again, dictated by what the hip wants or needs. And so then, from there, we say, okay, we'll practice that. Does that feel good or better or best? And as you're doing it, well, what if you change that slightly? Do you turn out or turn in a tiny bit or space wider or narrower? Find that groove, because once you've found your ideal squatting groove, it's probably not going to change.
Wow. I like that. I'm kind of going through it on my side here.
Yeah. And how I would say is, I think we get into this mindset, and there's even some incorrect teaching out there that says, okay, it's always feet straight ahead, shoulder width. Okay. Does that capture, two-thirds of the population? Probably. But again, that may not be appropriate for most of us, even like me, So I'm an interesting squatter because I use a slightly narrow stance with a tiny bit of toe out, but my toe out's greater on the left than it is on the right because I have an asymmetry between my hips. And so I can get into that groove and then I can squat through full range of motion pain-free. Whereas if I try to force and, bend my bones into a position where they're grinding up against each other, no bueno.
No bueno. Well, I think that how vivid. Put my bones in a position to grind against each other. Like, you convinced me to find my groove.
Yeah. So then we go to, we've gone through the stack. We've talked about the spine and pelvis and now the hips and stance. Next up is breathing. So this is a really interesting one because, how 10 years ago sleep was the hot topic and all those great books got written about sleep and it really, expanded our knowledge and awareness. Now it's breathing. And so we've got so much research and great books and people doing some great work on all aspects of breathing, breathing for health and how, we want to, how we want to have the maxillofacial structure and the, nasal breathing and what effects on sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems and so forth, so on, hormone regulation, you name it. Well, breathing and squatting go together quite well, like PK and Jay-Z. So there, I'm going to say some things and then I'm going to give some exceptions. And so in an unloaded capacity, so we don't have, say, weight on our backs or somewhere that we're trying to lift, you're just squatting with your body up and down. We want to be breathing in on the way down or the descend, and we want to be breathing out on the way up, on the ascend. And that's pretty basic. It's pretty much wired into the system. You can almost picture going back to that cylinder model as we compress the cylinder, breathing, taking in that air helps us. And then it gives us a little bit more boingy boingy as we explode up or blow up out of the squat.
Got it. Okay.
Now, having said that, I would say it is a little different. When you have a heavy load, you want to start decreasing variability. So we're very specific in the groove. And so that might be where you know, we might hold the breath through part of the range of motion of the squat, or even most of it, with a lot of muscle tension to support position. Like, so that's also true. It's just, you know, we got to look at how much load we're putting on the body or not. And this will all make sense when we get to the end, because we'll kind of put these things together. So now we go from breathing to actually just looking at descending or lowering in the squat. And I'm going to talk about it from two perspectives. Obviously, I was just doing this yesterday with a client across the screen, viewed from the side and viewed from the front. So when we're watching someone and just evaluating how they're squatting, or I'm doing that, and I'm looking from the side, what we want to see is vectors kind of evenly going forward and backwards. And what I mean by that is we need to blow up one of the old myths that you don't want your knees to go forward, or certainly not over the toes, is what was once thought. That's not true. You need to have both the mobility and the ability to do that, so that when we look from the side, yeah, you're going down, the knees are going forward quite a bit, the hips are going back a bit, the trunk is staying fairly upright until towards the end. That, you know, that's a good squat. Whereas, you know, if a person is getting hingy too early in their squat and all of a sudden their butt's kicking way back, you know, again, that's, now they're using the hinge pattern. They're not truly squatting. So to make it simple, I just tell people, look, imagine that you're in a phone booth, or if, you know, they're of the age where they don't have any idea what a phone booth is, I'll say, just imagine you're in a tube that's not much bigger than your body. And so you've got to go up and down and move things in ways that, you know, you can keep yourself fairly upright. And that helps them a bit.
Got it. Yeah, that's funny. I mean, or Google a phone booth, but that's interesting with the knees going forward over the balls of the feet. That's certainly been sort of like black and white. You don't do that. But I just did one when you were talking through it, and actually it feels a little better.
Yeah, and this is one of these things where you know, coming up you know, number of decades ago in this field, there was all sorts of thoughts you know, on that topic, and a lot of people, you know, I even paid money to go to workshops where people said, never let your toes, never let your knees go, you know, forward of the ball of the foot, for example, and really learn to sit back into squatting. And I thought, like, huh, you know, that seems like there's probably some application for that in some exercises. But if you train the body to do that, you can't walk up or downstairs because it's not possible. And and so I was like, something didn't make sense to me about that. And of course, over time, yeah, you know, the biomechanics research has just gotten so much better. It's like, not only is that not unsafe, it's how we need to be able to move. And so, looking at, like, say, the evolution and myth busting that happens in every field, and certainly, you know, here at the Lifetime Athlete, we try to be true to the science as well.
No doubt. Okay, so if we're looking at it from the side, then what's the other angle that we're looking at it from?
Well, I'm looking from the front. I mean, you can look from the back too, but like I usually say front and sides work for me. So now this is going to be another interesting one, because I'm going to say, this is what I do with folks all the time, because it's always fun when you get to use a cool term. And so I'm going to say, let's look at obligatory coupling. Okay. And, you know, so what we have in biomechanics is what's called obligatory coupling. So sometimes when you move, certain patterns or planes of motion sort of go together. And that's kind of all this means. Well, I like to not, you know, give too much information. Sometimes things work better when you just say, do this. And so if you're standing here and you're holding something that you're not trying to balance on, so you're standing on one leg. Now I'm just going to say, raise up your legs so that you can bring your foot closer to your mouth. And so when you do that, you probably do it just like an infant does laying down, because that's how we're programmed. You flex your hip. In other words, you're bending at the hip and pulling the leg up, but you also abduct and externally rotate. So by doing that, what I mean is, as you pull your leg up, your knee goes out and And there's some rotation as though you're trying to raise that foot up towards the head and even turn the sole of the foot up. Nobody will do it the other way around. And so that's a coupling pattern. That's the coupling of flexion, abduction, and external rotation in the lower extremity. Now, that's in an open chain or open kinetic chain. So the closed chain, when you're standing on the ground, sometimes things behave a little bit differently, but quite honestly, it's the same thing. So now I'm looking at someone descending in their squat from the front. Well, we know that that pattern that's happening at the joints is flexion, or in other words, bending in the joints, abduction. There's a slight, outward pressure moving away from midline, and then external rotation, that turning out. Well, it's happening in the joints more so in the limbs or the long bones. You don't see, like when a person is squatting, you don't see their knees go out. However, their knees don't or should not go in. And that's really the key thing. That's how that coupling works. So by letting that motion happen the way the joints are configured and the way the muscles are best firing is on the descent, make sure I'm being clear, they're going down in a squat. We don't see the knees come in. That's probably not desirable in most cases. The knees just stay out where they belong, which is, again, over the foot.
That is interesting. Again, keep going. I'm just making some notes here.
Okay. And this is going to make, again, a lot more sense as we put these pieces together and start looking at the whole thing. So we're doing like a part to whole teaching method. Now we're looking at ascending or going up, coming up out of the squat. And so when I view from the side, I'm just looking for that kind of like that vertical orientation. So that's those, concentric or overcoming contractions where a person is pushing up out of the hole. And that's what it's called, in lifting primarily. So I'm looking for that from the side. And so everything that's smooshed down is now going to be straightening back up. And we're not going to see some weird, herky jerky, honky tonky wonky, bend here, twist there. That's how people get hurt, because that's a movement pattern or a load acceptance that's not correct.
Right. Absolutely.
So I look at that, and then really where I'm getting excited is now I get to see from the front when they're coming up. And so this is where it's an interesting thing. When we're pushing up out of the hole and we're straightening the leg, so now we're combining extension, adduction, which is moving towards midline, and internal rotation in the limb. So now it's actually normal and common at some point in that range, particularly around mid-range in the squat, to see the knees come in a little bit. And that's just how the body harnesses power. And it tends to be effective and safe. And I'm not saying it's exaggerated by any means, but because it's a part of that pattern and the way, the feet are locked on the ground and the way the body is moving, that slight driving of the knees inward is, again, very normal, very common, and often desirable.
Absolutely. I'm tracking.
Okay. So then what makes this all make even more sense is foot pressure. So when we're standing on our feet, just standing up, getting ready to squat. So we've got the foot's behaving much like a tripod, so we've got weight through the whole foot. It's in the heel, outside ball, inside ball. And then as we lower, the weight distribution, this has been seen on, force plates or pressure platform analysis. The loading into the foot or where we're bearing weight will drift to the lateral side of the foot on the way down. Now, it's not like you're standing on the side of your foot and you've got your arches up in the air, foot's off the ground. No, it's not that. The foot is still staying flat. However, the loading in the foot is more lateral because, again, that's that external rotation bias that happens with descending. Mm-hmm. But then, as we start to push up, power delivered through the foot and leg drives off the medial ball of the foot and the big toe. That's what, when we're jumping or running, that's where the money's at. Everybody knows that. Well, that's what happens as we start to push up, that pressure shifts. And now the loading on the way up is going to be moving towards or being at the medial side of the foot. And, all these things work together in harmony, in concert, because all the limbs are timed to, you know, to do that pattern. And where some people get screwed up is if they're getting coaching that's trying to teach them to do something that the body's not made to do, or unfortunately, in a lot of cases, if a person has, let's say, a habit, a pattern, a stiffness, a weakness, where they start adopting these undesirable things. So we can identify that and correct it, especially if we're in the unloaded status.
Yeah. And I think that I'm imagining this, and I'm imagining it feels pretty good to do it this way.
Yes, precisely. And that's where the thing, if it's not feeling right, it's not right, you know? And so we find these natural grooves to move in these movement patterns, you know, we're doing something. Last thing in that list, as I went through everything from the stack, the spine, the hips, the stance, breathing, descending, ascending, and even foot pressure, is visual focus. And so really, this is a basic one. It should follow the spine angle. So in other words, looking at the spine from the side, you know, it's gonna be mostly vertical. It'll incline a little forward at the bottom of the squat and reverse back out. Well, we want to be looking perpendicular to that, you know, line of the spine. If you're looking up excessively, that's not necessarily appropriate, and nor rounding or bending down. Both those things will throw the balance of all these items we've talked about off a little.
Yeah, I think that last one, I've definitely practiced looking up too high then, you know, looking, you know, 5 feet above where perpendicular would be, just to try and keep my chin up. That was, you know, maybe with some heavier weight, but even still, I think that probably just dispelling some myths here, Jay-Z. I like it.
Oh, yeah. And it's so fun too, because, you know, life is an exciting journey. It's a humbling and learning journey for all of us. And so right away, we go from talking about the basics of the squat, you know, where we went through just some general principles and then those mechanics. Now we want to talk about, in training, the depth of your squat, or, you know, how deep should you go?
Let's hear it.
Well, as we have alluded to on the show before, we need to be careful or perhaps avoid using the words always and never. You know, a lot of circumstances, like when you're talking to your friend or spouse, you know, you always do this, you never do that. Those aren't really good relationship building strategies. Well, also, you know, when you look at movement, always train this way, never train that way. I don't know. I think sometimes we have to think about, well, what's the context that we're dealing with? What's the individual athlete? What's their goal? Where are they at in their training, age, or ability, et cetera? And so suddenly we want to be aware that we might not put limits on squat depth, at least too rigidly. So I'll give you some very general things. And I think I'm going to work from full to less than full. And so a full squat is sometimes called ATG or ass to grass squat. it can be loaded, but this is just, again, I think you're getting some consensus from the scientific community, but you're also getting my opinion here. It's really a tool for mobility. And so I like to do that body weight or light load for most people, and really work on improving their squat ability, their squat pattern, you know, working on getting enough ankle mobility to let those knees come forward so that they can sit at the bottom of the squat comfortably and not have the heels off the ground. You know, and again, when we're looking at a mobility squat or squatting as a rest position, we want to use the whole foot. Now, as I get towards the other side of this discussion, I'll remind us that in sports, you know, unless you're a catcher in baseball, you don't see people in a full squat. It's really not used very much in sports. And also, sports are not played on the heels. They're played on the balls of the feet. So as we move up, coming out of the squat, or let's say we're using less depth in the squat and more speed, we may want to increase 4 foot loading. But again, let's talk about that. So now I go to like the 3/4 squat. So that's below parallel. So, you know, obviously that's what you see in, you know, in powerlifting and most strength training, bodybuilding, and for sure. And that's probably one of the best ways to, work with load, build strength and hypertrophy muscle. Research is fairly supportive there. Some people, especially when you start looking at, say, Olympic lifters who do, snatch and clean and jerk, they're actually able to use loads in the basement or at rock bottom with a full squat. Some data supports, you get a little bit more muscle development if you're doing that, but there's also, relative risk and return types of things to talk about. So full squat for mobility, three-quarter squat for strength and hypertrophy. Now we go to that half squat. So that's kind of going down about halfway, knees 90-degree bend roughly. I'm going to say that that's a good place to develop power. Your strength and muscle development will happen if you go a bit deeper, but on a half squat, you're able to do that magical thing known as power work, where, we're combining strength and speed. And so there's some sustenance of effort there. So that's kind of an art form. And then lastly, the quarter squat, it's not a very deep squat at all. That's kind of a speed, development tool. Now I'll be careful to say that, bar speed or speed in a squat, or especially with resistance, is nowhere near the velocities we're going to attain in sports or sprinting or things like that. But there is some amount of carryover because of recruitment and intention. And so, working on explosive quarter squats. And I had this come up yesterday in my conversation with a client. He's like, well, I always saw people at the gym doing those kind of like fast quarter squats, and I just thought they're using poor technique. And then my answer was, they very well may have been, and that was all they were capable of. But on the other hand, they may have been in, say, like a phase or a training cycle where they're trying to work on enhancing speed development and elastic loading of tissue. And so doing quarter squats or even jump squats, depending on the resistance, is a good tool.
Interesting. I like how you broke that down, though, because it's not only one way to do it, and we talk about this all the time, it's what your goal is, and then working back and saying, how can I get there? So I really appreciate that. I learned a lot there.
Yeah, thank you. And I should preempt or just add in that I'm speaking mainly of, say, like a bilateral squat pattern. So yes, Looking at single leg or unilateral squats, split stances, I usually bring that into my lunge discussion because it tends to fit there better. So all the things we're talking about here are, 2 feet on the ground. Next up would be looking at a few of the types of loaded squats or techniques that we can use for training. And honestly, there are too many to name, although it's fun to look at how long of a list that can be. But we'll pick out a few of the major ones that I think are very common and I often use with my clients, and discuss kind of pros and cons.
Let's do it.
Okay. So it wouldn't be fair to talk about squatting without talking about the traditional back squat. I mean, everybody thinks of that. So mm-hmm. It's a barbell on your back. There is a high bar position, which most people use, resting just at the top of the shoulder blades. And then there's also kind of a low bar position, which is lower down, is used more in powerlifting applications. But here's the thing about back squatting. And again, if you're a listener and you want to discuss this more, or hopefully not ding me for saying this, feel free to engage. But back squatting is probably best if you are a power lifter, because that is the type of squat that you use in that sport.
Right.
It's probably the best way to get the most weight onto the body because it's resting up there. And so when you really are looking to do heavy, heavy loading, that's what we're going to do. Now, having said that, because of where that weight is and how it kind of puts force through those vectors we talked about of the body, in the foam booth or cylinder and doing all those things, it's hard to do a back squat with a barbell with a significant amount of weight on it the way I just described. Mm-hmm. You're almost having to get a little bit hingy, and that's kind of how, as this happens in powerlifting, because that's, again, how that works. And so, ironically, back squats are not the most functional exercise in the world, and it's moving away from popularity in the training of professional athletes in most sports, because, you know, we're starting to realize, well, gosh, you know, when strength and conditioning first started up, we kind of just borrowed a lot from powerlifting, weightlifting, and it became a convention to do this type of squatting. But it's actually, there's a lot better ways to put load on a body to make the outcome more functional and probably safer.
That's interesting. So naturally begs the question, what are some of those better ways? Are we going to get into those?
Man. So the money is in doing a front squat. So as soon as that weight comes, you know, to the front of the body, it naturally cues, you know, all those things that we just spoke about. And if you think about it, this almost makes friggin' ancestral sense, because if you were out doing stuff most of the time when you're picking up logs or rocks, you're going to hold them in front of you, you know, in fairly close, preferably fairly high. And that's how you're going to do things. Very rarely would you find a way to clean the weight and get it onto your back. Now, I'm not saying that couldn't have happened, doesn't happen, maybe a side carry. Yeah. But the front squat, you know, it's actually a little easier for most people to do, and it helps them to maintain those mechanics. Now, here's where it gets tricky. The classic front squat is done the way the Olympic lifters do it, in the catch position. And so that's, mm-hmm. you know, the fingers are very extended, as are the wrists, elbows are high, bars resting across the deltoid muscles. That's tough for most of us, honestly. And so bodybuilders will often put the bar in the rack, and they'll walk up to it, and they'll place the, you know, the bar there, and then they'll cross their hands and lift the elbows, doing it that way. So that's a bodybuilder style front squat. I still find that both of those things don't work as well for my clients. They don't always have Olympic lifting setups. And also, when you get some weight, you got to have huge delts really to stand the weight of that bar on your shoulders. And so I like the sandbag. And so that functional training sandbag that I'm always talking about, you know, showing people how to make or encouraging them to go buy, you know, a commercial Cordura bag, doesn't matter, but you got that sandbag, you can get it to, you know, up on your upper chest, almost under your chin, and support it easily with your hands. Molds to your body a little bit. Wonderful for squatting. And so front squat with sandbag, it's one of my money moves.
I like that.
Then we take it a step further and we say, okay, now let's break out a kettlebell and do a goblet squat. So a goblet squat, mm-hmm. You're holding the kettlebell. I like to use the handle hold in front of the body. You can do that with a dumbbell, like holding one bell or holding two bells. We call it the brandy keg hold. Doesn't matter. You've got a relatively smallish weight, although some of them can be somewhat heavy, held in front of the body fairly high. Well, here's the cool thing about the goblet squat is now it allows you, as you descend into the squat, if you're having a little trouble getting your range, your depth, you can move that weight, push that weight out away from you a little bit, and it creates a counterbalance, which then keeps you from falling over backwards as you work into greater depths. And so that's a nice, nice move there. And I will sometimes say also, if a person's got a lot of ankle mobility restrictions and we're working on them, but they're, you know, we want to get deeper in the squat before we get the ankles improved, you know, I might put a board under the heels or use a ramp, which makes that exercise very easy to hit full depth and stay vertical.
Definitely. Well, I can tell that you've definitely coached me on that. I've a goblet squat with a little lift underneath the heels. I like a goblet squat. It seemed to sort of help me probably without even, or definitely not without cognitively connecting all the dots, do all those mechanics things properly, and it just felt good. So I'm a fan.
Yeah. So you probably, if you just said, well, you got a front squat and a goblet squat, you're good to go. But then there's a few other ones that I like that are kind of fancy schmancy. So let's say if you went to a gym and you went to the hack squat machine, you know, so that's a machine where it's not the leg press. The leg press, you lay down and you push the push with your feet on a platform. This one, you're standing up in a slightly reclined or leaning back position, and you know, it's got kind of a shoulder pad and handles and whatnot on a sliding track. So you're still squatting, but there's some angles. Some of them are adjustable. Well, you can do a great modified hack squat at home, you know, fairly safely. So I'm going to say I like to put the board under the heels, and then we use dumbbells held at the side. You know, how heavy you have available or can go, there's some issues there, but also you can use cinder blocks and gym bags or whatever you've got. Mm-hmm. So there's always a way to create that win. But here's how I turn it into a hack squat. Since you have to be vertical when you're standing on the board with your hands at your sides, I will have a person use a band, you know, particularly one of those, like those newer, you know, heavy resistance bands people use for pull-up assists and things like that. Put it around, you know, their waist, pelvis, you know, hips, somewhere in that region. And then anchor it in front. And that allows you to kind of slightly lean back and get that extra recruitment that you would get on some of the anterior musculature from the hack squat. So it's a real safe way to do it. Just, you know, board, dumbbells, and then your belt resisted with the resistance anchored in front of you. And it's gold.
Excellent.
Then we look at what would be called a box squat, or you could use a bench, you know, depending on the height. And that's really where you're just putting that thing behind you fairly close, so that every time you go down, you kind of touch to make sure you're hitting your range and come back up. What to say about that is you don't want to like totally sit down and wait a couple minutes, check your phone, and then stand back up. You know, you want to, you know, kind of just not give up all of your load, but you use that as a cue, and it can also help you to kind of slow down, feel safe. One of the keys, though, is you got to make sure you get the box or bench way up underneath you, because if it's too far back, it'll just sort of, it'll teach you to do the hinge, which we might not be looking for.
Right. And really, it's just it's kind of like a stopper, like a height stopper, or like a tennis ball hanging from your ceiling in the garage where you're hitting it with your wind. You're going to that point and then back up.
Yeah, you can use it for cueing, for technique or range, and even for safety to some extent. But always, anytime you start to do things with a heavy load with squatting, it's best done with a spotter. You know, so if you're at the gym, that's, you know, generally something that's available, but always have a training partner. Otherwise, you know, if you're going heavy, because it's just not worth any risk.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so the last one, again, there could be many, many more, but this is one of my pet moves. I've come to adopt asymmetrical movements or positions or loads in the last few years. So I love having a person, let's say, you know, do a unilateral suitcase carry, walking around with something. I think that does a lot for us. I love having people slightly stagger their foot stance so they're not always squared up in the sagittal plane. Putting weight on, say, like one shoulder instead of both. I mean, love that stuff. But I also love using a kettlebell in what we'd call a unilateral rack position. So when you swing that kettlebell up, you know, and it rotates around to the back of the wrist, so your handle's up, bell is down, and you're holding that close to the body, you can rotate it what might be called front rack, side rack. You can even hang it what would be a back rack. Burt Bacharach, you know, he's a okay. Go there, but I like that side rack position with the kettlebell. And then you do a set, and then of course over time you do another set on the other side. But just getting folks to recognize, gosh, you know, life isn't always linear. In fact, it rarely is. And in fact, if I put this load in here, it actually makes my body work, you know, a bit more, a bit uniquely. Extremely effective, especially for athletes in different sport positions. And so that unilateral kettlebell rack position squat, I like to do it. I think we've got some of that programming coming up with the tribe next month even.
Interesting. I like that. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. I mean, honestly, there's not many, many different types of ways to do that. So I think that you hit the big ones. Let's talk about the training applications for the squat. If we're going for something, what do you recommend?
Yes, and so I probably had alluded to that a bit earlier, but now I can make it more clear. For mobility, when we're trying to restore, the squat function in all of us, we want to go fairly light with loading, loading, resistance, weight, whatever you want to call that. And fairly full with motion, preferably working towards, getting rock bottom or ATG, and even sometimes pausing at the bottom. So that's what I would do for mobility. And oftentimes if a person's deficient in their squat, let's say we do an overhead squat test and like, oh, okay, well, you're lacking ability to get your shoulders overhead. Maybe we got to stretch you out, particularly the lats. Oh, your upper back is a little bit too rounded. We've got to work on extension, so forth, so on. But a lot of it comes down to the ankles. And, if the ankles are just lacking that dorsiflexion mobility, there's separate exercises we can break out and do in conjunction with the squatting so that it becomes easier over time. So that's mobility, light and full with pauses at the bottom. Now for hypertrophy, that's the gains, bro. If you're saying, I want to be like Wahlberg or The Rock or, all these actors that, eat 8 times a day and they've got trainers pumping them, 2-3 hours. Well, you have to go to failure or pretty close to it in a number of sets to get that fatigue and that stimulus. And you need to train with somewhat higher volume. So squatting for hypertrophy, it's tiring. Fatiguing potentially takes days to recover from, but that's how you get the results. So you do moderately heavy resistance. Again, it's more about going close to failure than always going heavy. There's studies that support you can make a lightish weight still work to build muscle if you go to that suck factor. But you got to do enough of it. That's the point I'm making. So that's hypertrophy, kind of bodybuilding. Now, what's related to that, but a little different, is strength. When you want strength, and we know by definition, it's max force. It's one rep max. Not always is it appropriate for every person to do one rep max testing, but for most people, low rep heavy lifting is going to be fine. So maybe that's 3 to 6 reps. Possibly 2. And so that's where you work up through progressive sets, but then you load heavy, that's where, a couple of breaths, smelling salts, slap the face, yell death metal. And then you're friggin' blasting it. And then you're resting for 5 or 10 minutes before you're going again. And that's how you build strength. And so in a squat, that again, for most of us, we're going to get some strength carryover from doing, potentially less animated training than what I just discovered. But if you want max strength, that's how powerlifters do it.
Absolutely. What about if we're going for something like explosiveness?
Oh, I love that. Because I think that now you're starting to get into that. Now we're looking at really athletic movement. So you're combining strength and speed, and that's there. So there's that power. It's explosive. And so that's things like, oh, what's your vertical jump? Or, any kind of just, movement that looks, bam, like that. And so, that's where, we're probably going to look at those partials, at least in a training phase. We might do some of those other things, but we're going to get into doing half and quarter squats, at different loads, different speeds, particularly look at the forefoot emphasis, the load to be able to push hard through the ball of the foot, big toe. Again, that's what is going to be indicated in explosive athletic movement. So that's how it's done.
Absolutely. And finally, for power, how do we want to, if we're training for power, what do we do? How do we do the squat?
Yeah. So that, and again, it's one of these definition things. So, sure. So power is, it's just that ability to do rapidly repeated high force output or sustained for a bit of time. So, you're thinking about like power would be, like pushing a sled or say like, like a linebacker, gets under somebody and then drives them back 10 yards. That's power when we're looking at these applications. So I like to say we use a load speed blend. So by blending, like, okay, let's do some work that's heavy load, high intention. Our actual speed of movement's going to be a little less just because of that load. And then we might turn around and say, okay, now let's go lighter, really light, especially like even doing some things with light medicine balls where we can work on getting almost as close to the speed of actual sport movement as possible. So it's fun. It's so fun to be a coach and to be an athlete in these circumstances because you get to play.
Absolutely. Well, I think that that is, if we think about tying this all together, and this is what I'd like to ask you as we sort of, as we wrap up here, do you have like a handful of tips that you could just give someone who's jotting notes down for successful squatting as we round the corner and close out strong here?
Oh, yes. And I think I also may have alluded to some of those, but I've got a couple here that I'm going to share really quickly. So if you do an overhead squat, we use that sometimes in different movement screens to look at, you know, function and mobility and such. And your arms are forward. You're starting to squat down and you can't get your arms, you know, lined up with your ears and they're, you know, you see your hands out in front. That's a limitation in shoulder mobility. Can be for many reasons. Yes. One of the more common ones is tightness in that movement direction or the latissimus dorsi muscles. And so working on just stretching out, improving shoulder flexion mobility with some simple stretches can help that. And so that can get you functioning better. If that overhead squat has you looking down early, it's probably because your upper back is rounded and you need to improve your ability to extend that thoracic spine. So you can do that a lot of ways, but what's popular also gets foo-foo poo-pooed a little bit is the foam roller, but it's a good tool for that. So I would say, yeah, let's work on improving, breaking out that extension mobility. So then when you go back to squatting, it looks like you're back in that cylinder or foam booth.
I haven't heard the term foo-foo poo-poo before, but I like it.
So,
all right, keep going. You're on a roll.
And after a couple of years together, you're probably not surprised that I sort of make things up as I go along.
I mean, that's a good one. That's gold.
All right, brother. So now when we look at hinging, you know, and, you know, that's kind of, you know, hips are kicking back and you're, you know, kind of, taking a bow forward like it's some colonial scene or something. So if you're hinging early or you're feeling some hip discomfort, you know, it's pinchy. I don't like that. You want to try a couple things. First of all, just check your stack. Make sure that you can get into that position and then practice maintaining it as you descend. Also, you may want to enhance your hip mobility. And one of the popular ways to do that is to work on flexion, which is pulling having your knee come closer to your chest and rotation, the rotation in both directions. One of the ways that's popular to do that is to get into a half kneeling position where, you know, you're on some padding, you're down on one knee, the other foot's forward, kind of the typical quote unquote hip flexor stretch position. And you're using some bands to, you know, either assist or resist moving into those flexion and rotation positions. So how you do it is you have to be somewhat anatomically appropriate how you put the band on, but you want to slide it up into your inner thigh so that it's, you know, pretty close to the beginning of your leg. And I won't say any more about that. And then you might work in different, you know, oscillatory or lunging types positions as that resistance is pulling outward. So, you know, if it's on your outside, it's pulling into your inside, you're kind of working with that, or it's, you know, again, you can move that around in different directions, but that, again, I think that helps some. You're not going to bend bone, you know, you're not going to change bone, but if you have soft tissue restrictions, that's very effective. The other thing to do is double check stance. You know, you may just be in a habit of selecting a stance that doesn't fit your anatomy. And so if you go through some of those things that we talked about, you can accommodate your natural bone structure and suddenly make your squatting, you know, more comfortable, more effective. So let's see.
Get started off right.
Yeah, I'm just trickling down the body, I guess. I was at shoulders, thoracic spine, looking at some hip issues. And we were talking about early hinging. But now if we're seeing a person kind of bending forward, particularly rounding in the lower depths of the squat, most of the time that's driving to this ankle dorsiflexion mobility. So that ability to keep the foot flat and then drive the knee forward beyond the toes a couple of inches. So a plumb line dropping down from the kneecap is a good bit out in front of the toes. That's what we need to be able to squat fully. We ancestrally are programmed for it, but you know, modern life has taken that from us because we don't squat enough and we use shoes with heel lifts and all that business. So you can do some isolated stretching and mobilizing to improve that. And it's not super complicated how to do that. One of the better ways is to put your foot up on a bench and kind of lean into it like you're almost doing like a Achilles tendon, soleus muscle, calf stretch, and then use a strap or something to kind of pull down and backwards at the ankle. That's moving your talus bone, which is top foot bone, posteriorly in the mortise or the end of the tibia and fibula. So that's increasing posterior talocrural gliding mechanics. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to go somewhere and have some IREF on you to accomplish that. The other thing with the ankle is if you're struggling, practice with light loads getting deeper, but do some of your squats, especially the loaded ones, with the heel lift, and that's fine. Maybe just don't become addicted to it for life. And I'd say maybe this, trying to wrap this up. If you're squatting for mobility, just trying to improve your squatting, do it every day. Maybe a couple times a day, and it will be amazing how rapidly you'll just like, it's natural. I've got that now. But if you're going to load it up hard, again, back to training for strength, training for hypertrophy, that is so fatiguing on the central nervous system, and also breaks down tissue, which we have to recover from. Only do that once or maybe twice a week, depending on, again, your unique athletic circumstances. And so my final thought pulls this all together is I have two goals with every client, two main goals regarding the squat. Number one is, let's try to find a way to restore or maintain full squat mobility and capability. And number two, find an acceptable technique among the many that are available for your unique body that you can accept load for training.
Well, it sounds like both of those are infinitely possible. And to all the listeners out there, now that we've completed this, if you're still listening, you do know squat. But if you're interested in taking not just your squatting, but perhaps your entire athleticism to a new level, consider working with Coach Jay-Z at the Lifetime Athlete. So if you're listening, you like the concept of athletic fitness, where you want to develop a well-rounded, completely athletic body and beast, you can join the training tribe. So that's what we talked about at the top, where you get scientifically proven, fun programming, as well as masterclass education. So how it works is the training tribe uses an annual training plan based on block periodization. And the cost is minimal, less than $1 a day. So you could be a dedicated athlete in a chosen sport. Maybe you just want to crush some goals. Or you could want to work with Coach Jay-Z in a one-on-one capacity just to get started. So he's got personalized training programs, 24/7 coaching support. So all of this, you can learn more if you head over to lifetimeathlete.com. And I tell you, I had to give my guy a plug today because he can help you get you where you need to be.
Well, thanks, Broach. And thanks, audience. Love all you guys.
Adios. Have a good one.